Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the victory tour Donald Trump is taking across the Midwest and examine the deal that was made by Governor Pence of Indiana with United Technologies subsidiary Carrier to keep about 800 jobs in Indiana in exchange for state subsidies while still shipping over 1,000 jobs to Mexico as planned. Kevin Baker, an author and journalist who is currently a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of America the Ingenious, joins us to discuss whether Trump's appearance today at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis is him making good on his promise or a stunt and a terrible precedent of runaway corporate welfare, as Bernie Sanders is charging, that will incentivize big corporations to threaten to take jobs overseas in order to receive blackmail payments from governments to stay in America. Then we'll get an analysis of how Wall Street speculation continues to be the main factor behind the rise and fall of oil prices, which have just gone up by 15% following an agreement among OPEC members to cut production, which involved behind-the-scenes diplomacy by Russia's President Putin, who managed to get the antagonists Saudi Arabia and Iran to agree to a deal. One of the most quoted analysts on energy issues, Fidel Geit, Managing Director and Senior Energy Strategist for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to discuss the apparent capitulation by the Saudis, who flooded the oil market to kill off the shale oil boom, only to see the frackers thrive and their own budget deficits climb. Then finally, we'll go to Havana, Cuba, to speak with Antonio Gonzalez, president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. We will discuss the funeral procession underway in Cuba, where the streets across the island nation are lined with mourners as the ashes of Fidel Castro make their way to a final resting place. We'll look into who is among the world leaders gathered to pay respects and what changes might be ahead in Cuba as a new regime in the U.S. appears poised to go back to the past. And joining us now is Kevin Baker, who's an author and journalist, who is currently a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His books include City of Fire, a series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row, and he's the chief historical researcher on Harold Evans's best-selling history, The American Century, and his most recent book is America the Ingenious. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Baker.
Thanks for having me.
And Donald Trump is doing a victory tour of the Midwest, and of course, in Indiana, the Carrier Corporation that he railed against in his campaign for outsourcing jobs to Mexico, a deal has been struck through Vice President Pence, who is still the governor of Indiana, and apparently less than 1,000 jobs will remain in the United States, and over 1,000 jobs will, in fact, be transferred to Mexico. But the extraordinary thing is, and Bernie Sanders, by the way, has a very stinging op-ed in today's Washington Post, critical of the deal. During the campaign, Trump said, we're going to tax them, the United Technologies, the holding company of Carrier. But in fact, rather than tax them, they've given them a tax break. And surely this is setting a precedent where any big corporation can suddenly threaten to outsource jobs to Mexico or anywhere else. And suddenly they're going to get a vast government subsidy.
Yes, very much so. And as Senator Sanders writes quite eloquently, this is a hugely dangerous thing. And we've already seen it fail in the United States, and we see it constantly fail in the U.S. in terms of cities giving big subsidies to companies not to move out of them. And this went on particularly in New York under Rudy Giuliani. And again, companies were given enormous tax breaks on the idea that they would create jobs and stay in the city. Very, very often, they did not create jobs. And you see this constantly today in the way that major league sports teams in America go and hold up towns and communities for huge breaks to stay in those to keep their teams in those cities. I think possibly to this day, I'm not sure if the owners of Madison Square Garden are still paying any property taxes. That was the deal they cut with Ed Koch in the 1970s. You know, this is a really terrible precedent, and it almost never works. It just leads to more and more blackmail.
So United Technologies, what we're told is that Donald Trump used his leverage as president-elect over United Technologies, which is a big defense contractor. United Technologies, of course, last year made a profit of $7.6 billion and received more than $6 billion in defense contracts. Yeah. And its former CEO, as Bernie Sanders points out in his op-ed in the Washington Post, Louis Chevenevert, got a golden parachute worth more than $172 million. So this is a company that's not in trouble. Is there anything to this idea that there was some leverage? You know, we won't give you defense contracts if you don't. Because I don't see this a huge victory. I mean, what about 800 jobs will remain and the rest will go to Mexico as planned?
Right. And how easy will it be to duplicate this when you don't have the governor of the state the company is in, and when you don't have a defense contract you can threaten them with? You know, even if what Mr. Trump is saying is true, this seems to really be kind of a one-off. And it really, you know, the profit margins really reflect the mentality of all too many businessmen in America now. I remember Phil Knight of Nike saying some years ago that he could not afford to make a running shoe in America. And of course he could afford to make a running shoe. You know, he couldn't afford to make it at the profit margins he wanted to make. And this seems to be the story with Carrier too. And I admit it's a difficult problem to get them to stay in the country. But it's not something you do simply by paying them off. Like all blackmailers, they'll simply be back for more money the next time.
And again, I'm speaking with Kevin Baker, who's an author and journalist, who's currently contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His books include City of Fire, a series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. He's the chief historical researcher on Harold Evans' best-selling history, The American Century. And his most recent book is America the Ingenious. So let's then try and figure out here what Donald Trump's, whether this is an example of draining the swamp or corporate welfare. I mean, he's already getting a lot of criticism for his choice of Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who's very much a vulture capitalist who made a fortune out of the misery of others whose homes he foreclosed on. He's a creature of Goldman Sachs. His father was an important executive at Goldman Sachs, and he in turn went to work for them. Not that that necessarily disqualifies you. I mean, you can make the case that you need insiders to drain the swamp who know this, how crooked the system is. But sure. The real question is there any indication that these people are going to drain the swamp, or are they going to, as some are saying, just alligators entering the swamp? So what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, that was always the case, you know, when FDR hired Joe Kennedy to be the head of the SEC. You know, the idea was that he was the man who knew the inside game, and sure enough, he did. But Joe Kennedy was something of an outsider to the Wall Street establishment at the time because he was an Irish Catholic, and he was also somebody who harbored political ambition, so he wanted to get something done. It's not at all clear that the people Trump is hiring will do that. And it does seem pretty amazing for this sort of self-proclaimed populist to be hiring people who are not only from Wall Street, but in Steve Mnuchin's case, also in Hollywood, the very bastion of liberal elitism that they claim to despise.
Well, but you have to give Trump his due in the campaign. He did reach out to working class Americans, and a lot of union voters apparently voted for him. And the countervailing message from the Democrats, from Hillary Clinton, simply was there wasn't one, and there was a deafening silence. They didn't really reach out to working people, particularly in the last couple of weeks when Trump had very effective campaign commercials about outsourcing, etc. So to my sense is maybe Trump did get elected because at the very least, even if these deals are largely cosmetic, at least you have to give him credit for, you know, reaching out and taking these people seriously and talking to the and addressing their needs, which the Democratic Party used to, that used to be their base.
Oh, certainly. And I feel this is the great failing of Clintonism. And I would include President Obama as a Clintonist. You know, I think they're very sincere about their interpretation of how the world is changing. they're not wrong that it's not only about outsourcing, it's also about people being replaced by machinery. And they do, you know, and to Hillary's credit, she did have a laundry list of small but practical ideas that the media kind of ignored, and President Obama has operated along sort of the same lines. But they do need to come up with the big idea, the big appeal to, as you say, the traditional base of the party. You know, the sort of the Clinton idea is, well, all those old industrial factory jobs are gone, and they really didn't need to go this quickly, or devastate local communities as much as they did. But they're going to be gone. Automation is going to replace a lot of workers, and their only solution seemed to be, well, everybody needs to get 2 degrees and go into a white collar job, and that's something that's simply not practical in a country where 70% of the population doesn't graduate from college. You know, the 30% who do, that's a tremendous testament to both government attempts to aid people through college and to people's own industry and ambition. You know, it used to be about 5% of Americans graduated from college at the end of World War II. So that's been a tremendous increase. But you're simply not going to get to a point where we all have master's degrees or PhDs and, you know, reprogram computers or do whatever. There had to be something that they addressed more directly to help people with what they were going through. I think one aspect under the Obama administration was the failure to come up with a really effective program to keep people in their homes. You know, historically, a lot of people will say that Roosevelt didn't solve the Depression. And, you know, you can argue that one way or the other. But what he did do was keep people in their houses, kept people in their jobs, provided government jobs for them, resettled them, got them new farms, things like that. And that's the sort of, way in which the Clintonistas should have been thinking for many years now, and it's all kind of come home to roost with this election, where they finally so alienated a lot of the white working class that they jumped ship, however, I think, suicidal a fashion as they did.
Well, it does seem, though, that the question is hanging out there, whether this carrier deal that Pence made and that Trump is trumpeting today on his victory tour, whether it is basically largely cosmetic and a stunt, or whether it's an indication of a policy change. Now, you have to also remember that Donald Trump is responsible for Trump University, which was a scam, and that's a part of a bigger scam, which is the for-profit college racket that drains about $40 billion worth of taxpayers' money per year, which goes mostly into advertising to get working-class young men and women, and a lot of whom are vets, into these colleges that are worthless. Yeah. They get ended up with a lifetime of debt and a worthless diploma. Now, what should be happening if any of these people, particularly the damn Democrats, were paying attention to this racket, and many former Democrats are involved in this racket, along with ex-Republican congresspeople, like Steve Gunderson, who runs the industry trade group for the for-profit college racket. The alternative would be to invest in trade schools to give blue-collar workers the kind of education they need to get these higher-paying jobs. Then, which is about $60,000 a year compared to, which is $20,000 a year more than the typical service job. So that, to my mind, is the real failure, is that we're not, this Band-Aid of giving, getting a government subsidy to keep a company, employ 800 people that the jobs are going to go to Mexico, fine.
Yeah.
But what about, investing in the kind of technical schools and we have community colleges. It's not like the infrastructure doesn't exist. It just needs to be infused with capital, and you can take the $40 billion that's going down a rat hole to make a bunch of crooks in Washington rich and indenturing generations of students with debt.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we need to step back and kind of look at this bigger picture and see how we are going to live in the future here. You know, and there's no reason why the 40-hour week should be written in stone. You know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the newspapers were full of all of these sorts of cartoons mocking the idea that you'd have a 40-hour week instead of the usual 60 to 80-hour week for workers. And cartoonists would depict workers in their work clothes and their hats, you know, plays they'd read in the libraries, you know. This was the sort of thing that was just seen as absurd. But sure enough, the 40-hour week came around by the 1930s. Maybe it's time to go to the 20-hour week at a 40-hour wage. And, you know, maybe it's time to start talking about a guaranteed minimum income, as they're talking about it in Europe now. And I don't think anything particularly bad would come of this. From this book I've just written, America the Ingenious, I think a lot of Americans would spend their time inventing great new stuff in their garages. Others would do things like, spend more time with their kids and make sure they're better taken care of and better educated. Others would probably goof off and spend a lot of money that way. So I don't think there's any kind of, you know, downside of trying to think in these bold new terms instead of the sort of, you know, very admirable but kind of minor ideas that Hillary Clinton came up with in this last campaign.
Well, just in closing, do you think that Donald Trump is going to make America great again, or that we're going to have more of these kind of stunts?
Oh, I think we're going to very much have stunts, and I think to a great degree that was how Ronald Reagan operated. But with Reagan, it was a more divided government, and you were better able to channel things toward some positive outcomes. I don't think that's going to be the case now when he can sort of run amok. I think we're going to see all sorts of stunts. And I think he could well be quite popular, at least in the, you know, immediate future, maybe even for 8 years. But I think there's going to be a tremendous price to be paid in all sorts of ways, in terms of environmental damage, in terms of handing things over to Wall Street again at the end of this whole period.
Well, Kevin Baker, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, Kevin Baker is the author and journalist who's currently a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. His books include City of Fire, a series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. He's the chief historical researcher on Harold Evans's best-selling history, The American Century, and his most recent book is America the Ingenious. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the 15% rise in the price of oil following an agreement among OPEC members to cut production.
Bottom don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Fidel Guide, who is the Managing Director and Senior Energy Strategist for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Guide has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and was previously been with Mobil Oil and the J.P. Morgan Company in New York. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fidel Guide.
Thank you for having me.
And something unusual happened, which was that OPEC came to an agreement. Obviously, there's been a history of infighting amongst the big players in some of the non-OPEC countries like Russia. And oil, of course, plunged from $100 a barrel down to $40. And a lot of the reason behind that, apparently, was the Saudis thought that they could break the back of the shale oil market here in the United States in particular by lowering the price. That appears to have not worked. So is this a case of the Saudis throwing in the towel?
Well, it is the final action, if you will, is they blinked first. Shale producers are here to stay. Saudi Arabia and OPEC have made a big mistake a few years ago when they dismissed shale as a fluke. It is not likely to move the needle in the global supply. And they were wrong because they were fighting against technology. And technology and time are not on OPEC side. Technology created a new cast of character. They are the frackers, the shale producers. Continue to reduce their cost structure, improve operating efficiency, and we thought that they could not survive at oil prices below $80. Not only that they survive the $40 oil and the $30 oil, they actually thriving on $50 oil, which nobody had expected any time in the last 5 years. So now it's reality. Shale is here to stay. Technology continue to improve, and eventually we are going to see shale production growth come back. Probably in the middle of next year, we are going to see visible production growth in shale, provided that oil prices remain in the $50-plus dollar range.
Well, they've jumped 15% from $46 per barrel to $54 per barrel for Brent crude. So do you think that that's a pretty sharp jump? Is it going to continue, or do you think it's going to have some plateau soon?
You know, I've been in this business long enough to say oil prices don't go to in any direction in a straight line. They are exaggerated in the way up and they exaggerate in the way down because of the excess speculation, because the financial players. The oil market is not really controlled by OPEC or Saudi Arabia. They're controlled by the financial players. These are the guys that place bets projecting where oil prices would be 6 months from now or a year from now. And often they are wrong, but they quickly change their position and create havoc in the market like we have seen in the last 2 days. There is no change in the supply and demand, as far as I can see, that would justify a 10% increase in oil prices. It's just unfathomable. But it did, and it happened. And there is actually a follow-through today. You know, additional few points increase in oil price. Having said that, I would not rule out a pullback. But what got us in this situation is oil prices corrected severely on the way down. They were exaggerated on the way up. We should not have had $100 or $120 or $150 oil. And we also should not have had $20 oil back in March. So it is two extremes, two wrongs don't make right. And unfortunately, it's always the case. There is always very big volatility on the way up and on the way down. Usually, again, the market is has self-correcting mechanism. And the market is telling us very clearly that the $30 oil was not sustainable because the energy, the oil industry cannot support capital spending levels to maintain production at $40 oil. It's impossible. They need probably $50 or $55 oil just to prevent a precipitous decline in production, let alone maintaining production or growing production. So the industry needs hundreds of billions of dollars annual spending in order to keep the current production level flat, without even increasing it. So you can see the correction went way down when oil prices declined. And also we are seeing a rebound in oil prices today. I still believe that oil prices will have to go even higher in order for the industry to feel comfortable spending more money.
And again, I'm speaking with Fidel Guite, who is the Managing Director and Senior Energy Strategist for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Guite has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. But let's just reiterate what you've told us, Fidel. it's not Saudi Arabia and the other OPEC players and the non-OPEC players like Russia that really determine the price of oil. It's speculation on Wall Street. Is that a bottom line?
Two things. Number one, fundamentals eventually will rule. But in the meanwhile, the volatility, the daily changes in oil prices, the market does not change overnight. It's the perception that might change. And then the speculator, you know, just convert their perception into future oil contracts. And that's what creates the volatility. Again, what is happening here is that oil prices cannot remain at the current level because the current oil price would not allow the marginal cost producers to stay in business. And we need, it's not Saudi Arabia that will dictate where oil prices will be. Believe it or not, it's the frackers, the shale producers, because they have the highest production cost. So the price of the commodity will be determined by the marginal cost of production. Saudi Arabia can produce oil at less than $10, but they need close to $80 to balance their budget. That's another story. But shale producers, because shale is very quick response, if you will, oil companies can put rigs to work within 2 weeks. You cannot put a project in the deep water Gulf of Mexico. It probably take between 3 and 5 years to do it. So that's why shale production is very, very critical to the future prices of oil. Because at the end of the day, shale production is the swing producer. It's no longer Saudi Arabia. It's no longer OPEC. It's the shale producers will determine where prices will be. If oil prices continue to rise, shale production will increase sufficiently to move the needle and will be what I call the speed bumps, will not allow oil prices to go out of control on the way up and will not allow oil prices to go down and stay down for a much longer period of time.
And what do you know about the role that Vladimir Putin played? Apparently he played an active role behind the scenes with both the Saudi Deputy Crown Prince and Rouhani, the president of Iran. You know, they're mortal enemies, the Saudis and the Iranians, but somehow Putin apparently managed them to agree to this deal.
Well, what they have in common, all oil-producing countries and companies, is that they are suffering from low oil prices. You know, if oil prices remain low for much longer periods of time, I would not be surprised at all to see regime changes, including Russia. At the end of the day, when people get hit very hard in the pocketbook, they change. They are angry and they want to get even, regardless of how powerful the regime is. Regime change would be will be most likely. It is unsustainable. It is unsustainable. Russia cannot obviously run its economy on $50 oil. You could hardly do that on $100 oil. They got used to the higher oil prices, and increasing production is just going to put them in a deeper hole. The Saudis tried the same thing, you know, try to compete for market share, but at the end of the day, it cost them over $250 billion over the last 2 years to balance their budget. So it was inevitable that Saudi Arabia, OPEC, and Russia will blink, because they have to do something. Do you know that they pushed the frackers, the shale producer, as much as they can and as hard as they can? And guess what? They are still there. They survived. And they are much more resilient to low oil prices than any time in their history. The fracking business is only 10 years old. Technology continues to improve. The recovery rate for shale started at 1%. Today, it's close to 10%. And economy and technology is not going to sit still, continue to advance, continue to improve. So companies are doing things cheaper, faster, and better than ever before. So therefore, they are lowering their break-even price. Their break-even price is no longer $80 or $70 or $60. It's between $40 and $50. But to make money, they will need, obviously, higher prices, $50 to $55. So I think we are going to see a new normal for oil prices. The $40 oil is not a normal price. The $100 oil is not a normal price. It was amplified by speculation. But to run the business, we probably need about $60 to $65 for oil companies to get good return on their investment, because they are taking risk. They are, you know, producing a commodity. They have no control over the price. So therefore, they have to build a cushion, if you will, that they can invest and feel that they are going to get rewarded for their investment. And that is what I think is going to make shale more resilient going forward to oil prices. And obviously, there is no way that OPEC can drive shale producer out of business, because the most they can do is that they can force the consolidation in the industry. And instead of having 200 oil-producing companies in the U.S., we will have 20 or 30. But these are going to be harder to crack, harder to push around, and therefore they will survive. And OPEC will be sorry for doing that.
Well, hasn't there been a major discovery in Texas?
Well, that did. All the shale oil that we talk about today has always been there. Mm-hmm. The Geological Survey of the U.S. has, you know, mentioned shale oil 55 years ago. Mm-hmm. We knew it was there, but we didn't have the means to extract it economically. Until 10 years ago, we started with horizontal drilling and then hydraulic fracturing. And that basically cracked the code. And, you know, the rest is history. Companies learn from their own experience and the experience of others and pool the resources. And basically it became, you know, an intellectual war. Technology ruled. And unfortunately for OPEC, they totally dismissed shale. As this is not time series going to last. It's cost. Yes, the first barrel of oil shale came at the break-even point of over $95. But today, it's probably less than half that, depending on where you are and how advanced the company. You know, like the metaphor of baseball, we are not in the bottom of the ninth inning yet in technology. We're probably in the third or fourth inning. So we have plenty of time left to catch up and do better.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Fadelga, let's turn to Russia's role and what Russia agreed to. They agreed to production cuts. So how does this work out? If you get the price up per barrel, how do you work out the ratio between how much you pump and how much per barrel? Because obviously if you pump more oil at a less price, what's the difference between that and pumping less oil at a higher price?
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about OPEC has agreed to cut production by 1.2%, 1.2 million barrels per day. Mm. And that is a very small percentage of their 33 million barrels a day of production, less than 2%. Now, if you look at OPEC, 1.2 million barrels of promised cuts, and non-OPEC, including Russia, of 600, that's 1.8 million barrels. The global supply is 95 million barrels a day. So, again, you're talking about small percentage. Now, look at it this way. If I'm an oil-exporting country, and all of a sudden I am going to be willing to cut my production, say, by 2%, but look what happened to the price. The price jumped by more than 10%. So that's fivefold increase. You give some, but you gain much more. And that is what's happening here, is that very small percentage of supply up or down will have significant impact on price. It is not 1-to-1 ratio. It's more to 5 to 10-fold depending on where we are in the price range.
But again, just in closing, it is not the oil producers that are essentially responsible for the price of oil. It's the oil speculators, and they're largely on Wall Street, right?
Correct.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Fadel Guite.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Fadel Guite, who is the Managing Director and Senior Energy Strategist for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Guite has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and was previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And he's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Havana, Cuba to look into Fidel Castro's funeral procession crossing the island nation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Havana, Cuba, is Antonio Gonzalez, president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. He currently appears as a regular commentator on Public Radio International's Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio program here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, Antonio, we saw, of course, the front page picture on the New York Times today of Cubans lining the streets across the country, this tiny island country of Cuba. I take it that this procession will continue until Sunday, when the nine-day period of mourning will end. So just give us a flavor of what we haven't seen that much in terms of our local TV coverage. But I take it this has become a sort of national event, if not obsession, over the last few days.
It's a national outpouring of the likes of which I have personally never, ever seen. And it is so striking coming from the United States over the weekend. I was still in the States, and we saw this orgy of hatred coming out of Miami, and really played up by the U.S. corporate media, and it looked, you know, somewhat big. And Cuba was sort of waiting, so, okay, what would the island be like? And, of course, the narrative from Miami was, you know, the Cubans all, they're wet tired of the revolution, and they're so happy to see Fidel go, so now they can have freedom. And then I got to Cuba on Tuesday, and of course, what you saw in Cuba was hundreds of thousands of people going through the Revolutionary Square in a long line to pay their last respects to at a Fidel monument set up there, like a picture of Fidel and some flowers, just like 24/7, a procession of everyday Cubans. This was on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And then on Tuesday, there was a gathering in Havana, and I think conservatively it was 500,000 to 1 million people. And then they call it the caravan, started a slow vehicular procession from one end of the island to the other, carrying Fidel's ashes. And I kid you not, thousands of people per mile, every mile, on the national highway and going through the main towns. And it's still going on. It is still going on. You literally have millions and millions and millions of Cubans turning out across the country to pay their final respects to Fidel. And it's an active crowd. I mean, they are cheering and clapping and chanting and with music and poetry and speeches constantly. And, you know, and it's not just like every day at 12. It's like a slow percent. So there's people that, you know, if they go through your town at 2 a.m., you're out there at 2 a.m. If it's there at 9 a.m., you're out there at 9 a.m. And it is it's incredibly impressive. It's just such a response to the exile community in Miami. And it shows the proportionality. I mean, I know there are people that don't like Fidel in Florida, you know, in America. But the active group is in Florida. But they are dwarfed by the Cuban population that is supportive and recognizes the contribution of, they call him the commander-in-chief here, Comandante en Jefe, Fidel Castro. It's amazing.
And is this basically retracing the steps that Fidel Castro and his band of revolutionaries took when they came out of the Sierra Maestra Mountains back in 1959 and overtook the country? It seems like it's the reverse, right? The reverse journey?
It's from the western, Havana's in the west, going all the way to the east. And the revolution, the Cuban Revolution is always considered to have begun in the east at the second city, Santiago de Cuba. And they say here in the revolutionary lore that that's really the heart of the Cuban Revolution, where its support is greatest. And that's where Fidel is from. He's from a rural town outside of the big city in the east. His parents were farmers, landholders. And he's going to be buried there in the same cemetery where the national sort of founding father of the Cuban nation state, Jose Martí, is buried. Jose Martí was killed during the Cuban War of Independence from the Spanish in the 1890s. So his ashes will be put to rest. He was cremated the day after. Cremated, I guess, Saturday morning. Or Sunday morning, I guess he died Friday. It's all, you know, so many things are going on here. It's all fusing together. But it's pretty interesting stuff. Alcohol is banned, and music is banned, except for this, you know, like you know, fun music. Like, you know, so it's a sort of like a solemn, they call it National Days of Mourning, 9 days of mourning. So I'm here and I can't get a drink.
Well, tell me about what happened on Tuesday night in the Plaza of the Revolution. I take it a lot of the foreign leaders that have come to pay their respects, the presidents of Mexico, Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, and South Africa are among them. And there were a bunch of smaller countries as well represented. The U.S. sent the Deputy National Security Advisor, and speeches were made. And, of course, Raul Castro, the younger brother, who's 85, gave a speech as well. So did you see any of that, or was it on television?
I've been watching it on TV. It was replayed. I was actually coming in as the it was massive. The footage that I've seen, I mean, that square holds a million people, and it was full. And as I was coming in, it was breaking down, and I kid you not, probably 50 buses headed out to the airport. You know, like those luxury buses, and that was, of course, the delegations from the other countries. And I read that there was something like 40 or 50 delegations, and just a comment, I thought it was a little embarrassing that President Obama did not attend. and Vice President, or Vice President, the Vice President. The United States should have been represented, particularly because, arguably, Barack Obama's most important foreign policy achievement is the restoration of diplomatic relations with Cuba and the weakening of the, I mean, it's not over yet, but the embargo against Cuba has been significantly weakened. And the president should be proud of what he did. I mean, he did visit Cuba, and it makes no sense for him not to, just from a diplomatic protocolar perspective, not attend or send VP Biden. It's a little bit, I thought, you know, conceding to the Miami hysteria, a little shameful.
Well, it would be particularly helpful at this time, surely, given the uncertainty about what Donald Trump is going to do vis-a-vis Cuba. Donald Trump tweeted recently, if Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal. So, you know, one would think that if Obama went there, that would be a way of signaling that, you know, you're going to cancel this deal over my dead body.
Well, yeah, exactly. The president put substantial capital into beginning the restoration and normalization process for Cuba. He received worldwide accolades for doing it. The American people support it. The Cuban people, both in the U.S. and in Cuba, support it. One would think you would, I mean, he's no friend of Trump. One would think you would double down to protect your legacy. And I just thought it was inexplicable that he didn't. And but maybe it's consistent because Trump is inexplicable too. I mean, he in his message about threatening Cuba with canceling the deal, he mentioned things like more religious liberty. Cuba used to have problems with religious liberty. It hasn't had problems in 20 years. I mean, that was something long ago, Fidel Castro and the revolution made a self-criticism, a public self-criticism, and removed any restrictions on worship and the organization of churches. And there was a vibrant Catholic church. All the denominations are represented here, as well as the Santeria, which is actually the majority of Cuban faithful. Don't belong to Western religions. They belong to African-based Santeria religions. So it just shows how misinformed Mr. Trump is, and frankly, how out of step he is, because the majority of U.S. visitors to Cuba are, in fact, Cuban-Americans. So if you want to cut the deal, the deal is basically travel privileges. For American citizens who happen to be Cubans. They're not American they're not white Americans. They're Cuban Americans that are the majority still. You would be, in fact, stepping on the tail of the same Cubans that mostly voted for you. So and somebody's not staffing Mr. Trump well. And I think it'll be harder than you think that he thinks if you want to go back on this deal, because, I mean, you just don't break relations with the country, A. B, there are now lots of ties between the U.S. and Cuba. The fact that I'm talking to you on my AT&T cell phone is one of those. It works now. Never used to work. I get my texts. I get my cell phone. I get my emails. I can talk to you. I can make calls. There's a lot of ties developing, a lot of U.S. airlines traveling, a lot of Cubans traveling. There's a constituency for relations with Cuba that didn't exist before, and it's massive. And I don't think they would be happy at all if Mr. Trump, you know, did something ill-conceived and poorly thought out in terms of relations with Cuba.
Well, on the religious issue that you brought up, of course, the fact that the very conservative former Polish Pope John Paul, who visited Cuba, and of course that whole visit was completely distracted by the Monica Lewinsky affair, and all the press left to cover Monica Lewinsky and ignored this historic opening with the Catholic Church. But then this current Pope Francis is the one who brokered the deal between the U.S. and so...
There's a robust and vibrant relationship between the revolution and the Catholic Church. Just, you know, who knows who's staffing Trump on this? Maybe no one. Maybe that's the problem.
Well, give us a sense then, Antonio Gonzalez, since you're there in Havana, Cuba, of... Is there any trepidation amongst Cubans? Have you talked to any politicos about what they think is going to happen vis-a-vis, you know, here they are, in effect, you know, the expectation is that with Raul now in charge and not having the shadow of his brother will probably accelerate reform. So the Cuban position appears to be that they want to move into the future, and there's a fear on the American side that we want to go back to the past.
That's what one perceives on the ground. I mean, I've been coming to Cuba for almost 20 years now, and you know there was a constant dialogue. You know, the American position was why don't you have more freedom and you know, private enterprise? And the Cuban position would always be, well, why don't you quit, you know, threatening us, the most powerful country in the world, with your embargoes, and let's be honest, terrorist actions and destabilizing actions. I mean, come on, let's cut that out, and then we'll see. Well, as the relationship has improved, there has been an opening in Cuba. More than... half a million Cubans are now in the private sector and micro enterprises, and you have one of the big critiques of the revolution was that they didn't have freedom for LGBT people and so forth, religious freedom. In fact, they do now. There's a robust and vibrant LGBT sector that have been legalized for more than a decade, religious freedom for two decades. So there are slow but sure reforms in Cuba, private sector reforms, a lot of foreign investment coming not from the U.S., but the Cuban economy is now open for business with the world, and that's been going on for 20 years now, and the U.S. has lowered its threshold. They've taken Cuba off the terrorist list. Political prisoners have been exchanged. You know, the U.S. had Cuban political prisoners, and there were political prisoners in Cuba. There was an exchange in 2014. All these things are happening, and it's just the narrative coming from Mr. Trump is like a narrative taken out of the 90s or the 80s, just really 20 years out of date. And, you know, the Cubans here, they are worried. You know, they like, we thought we were trying to be friends. You know, they read that. That's the memo they got in Cuba. Let's be friends. Let's work our differences. Let's make progress. There's all kinds of cooperation deals with the Obama administration, the Cuban government now on drug interdiction and immigration and so on and so forth, climate change. And then Trump comes up with a 20-year out-of-date discourse. So there's worry. There's concern. But there's also resilience. I mean, the Cubans will tell you, look, we lived without the United States for 50 years. We can go another 50.
Well, what's happening now, though, with the emigration? You know, there's always been people getting out of the island on little rubber inner tubes and all kinds of rickety crafts, but the U.S. has had this wet foot, dry foot policy, which favors Cubans arriving in the United States. My understanding is, in spite of all this nonsense about building a wall to keep Mexicans out, most of the people crossing the border now are Cubans. They come in via Mexico. So what's going on there?
Well, the context to understand is there's always been Cuban migration to the U.S. You know, it's a neighboring country, you know, rich country next to a poor country. So there's always been migration, just like with every other Latin American country that has a nexus with the United States, there is a migration. Cuban migration to the U.S. is actually smaller than other Latin American countries to the U.S. It's a smaller share of the population than Mexico, than Puerto Rico, than the Dominican Republic, and then Central America. Historically smaller. That's the first bit of context. The second bit of context is Cuban immigrants, and they're not refugees. No one argues they're refugees anymore. They're economic immigrants like other Latin American countries. Have a permanent amnesty. It's called the Cuban American Adjustment Act. It was passed in 1967, and any Cuban that gets to the United States, migrates to the United States, they don't run from the authorities, they run to the authorities and turn themselves in and say, okay, I'm from Cuba, and they get automatic temporary permanent status, which is quickly followed by permanent legal status and citizenship with all the benefits, with all the bells and whistles. So, you know, you hear the anti-immigrants in the United States railing against legalization and say that'll be a magnet. But in fact, there is an amnesty, and it's for Cubans. So there's a magnet for them, and their Cuban migration to the U.S. has had a small uptick. Emphasis, it's not a big migration. Mm-hmm. It's a small migration. But it has had an uptick because in Cuba, there's this constant, urban rumor that the Cuban Adjustment Act is going to be repealed now that the U.S. is normalizing, in quotes, headed towards normalization with Cuba, because why do you need it?
Sure.
If it was there because Cuba was, at war with the U.S. and now we're becoming friends, then you don't need it anymore. And that's been the line of the Miami exile political leadership, because they were mad that Cuban Americans are now, before 2016, appeared to be voting more Democrats. They're like, well, why should we help reward you if you're going to be for the other party? So, in fact, Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, and others from the Cubans that are in the U.S. Congress, Liliana Rosmetten, et cetera, are the ones that have been agitating to repeal the Cuban Adjustment Act, which caused a scare in Cuba, and thus the flow.
Well, Antonio, we've run out of time here today, but I thank you so much for joining us from Havana.
Thank you, Ian. I could just talk to you about Cuba forever, but I know we're out of time.
Well, we'll catch up with you on Monday. And again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. He currently appears as a regular commentator on the Public Radio International's Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles called Strategy Session. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.